is in Deco. Just give it a few more minutes because we still have a few people coming in. There's still a lot in there. Yeah. It's still coming through. Okay, so I think we're going to start. It's a big schuss for us to have Rabbi Tetz join us this Motzei Shabbos and to be able to address the Olam. He's actually come out for a Kiruv program. He has a long history of being very successful in Kiruv, but also, for those who didn't know, Rabbi Tetz started as a physician and then went into Kiruv, and hopefully he's going to give us some insight into medicine and immunization. So we thank you very much for being here. And
first of all, good luck and thank you very much for this opportunity to learn a bit together and to learn how to speak English correctly. Thank you to Dr. Friedman and the Chemed Clinic for this chance to think through a basic area of Hashkofa and learn some Torah together. Can you hear me at the back?
Yes.
Move forward. Move a little bit forward. I'll speak as loud as I can. The question of risks and dangers, of which the risks of immunization, the risk of non-immunizations are part, is an opportunity to talk about a broad area of Hashkofa, namely the question of Ishtadlus, Bitochon, how much effort do you make, how much do you not make, how do you approach that whole area, a classic and very broad area. Just let me say a word of background for what it's worth. I was brought up in South Africa. I spent many years in medicine. I was a military physician for a couple of years that was required in South Africa. And then I moved into practice in Israel. I did some time in internal medicine at Washington University in St. Louis. But most of my time has been in internal medicine and general practice. And let me say at the outset, I'm in favor of immunization. I don't know if that was clear from the poster. I don't know whether you've come to insult me, attack me, agree with me. Yeah, I don't exactly know what how you do these things in Lakewood. But I think the right thing is to immunize children. I'll try to show you why. I was trained in conventional medicine. I've never had training in homeopathic or alternative medicine. I'm open to it, and I think we ought to accept evidence wherever it leads us. I think that's the right attitude. But I certainly have a conventional background and training, and you're probably aware that the ishtadlus we are required to make, in other words, the effort we are required to make, basically follows the norms that are current. Try to explain why that is, even though the norms that are current might not be good. You know that a very important insight here that I think grounds the subject is this. Rabbi Avigdor Miller used to put it like this. You know that the Torah says Verapa Yerapeh. And the question is, what does that really mean? What does the mitzvah mean? The conventional take is, it means there's a mitzvah to heal, and the reason you need to know that is because you might think that if someone's ill, you have no right to interfere with that. Hashem has made them ill, that's what they need. In case you think such a thing, the Torah says, that's not right, you need to heal. But there's another overtone to that as well. It's very important for physicians to know. And that is, when the Torah tells you to heal people, it doesn't tell you how. It says, go get healed. So you go to the doctor and he tells you to take X, Y, Z, or do this, or do that, have an operation. The Torah never ratified that. So here's a very important insight. The standard that you need to apply is the standard of your time and place. Now the problem with that is, we know from the history of medicine that stuff changes all the time. Right? My father was a physician before me. The things that he was taught to do, if I did them today, they'd be criminal. He was practicing good medicine in his time, that was the norms. And the history of medicine shows that every 5 or 10 years they change their minds completely. What they do now in 5 years' time will be wrong and probably criminal. Probably only setting a broken bone is, you know, hasn't changed over the last couple hundred, you know, 1,000 years maybe. But everything else changes. And changes in radical ways. Not just that it sort of falls out of favor, but we discover that it's downright wrong. Even things that are very well established, I'll give you lots of examples. So here the Torah says, your job is to do what's current at your time and place. That's the standard. You can't do better than that. In 5 years' time, or 10 years' time, or 20 years' time, when they show that's wrong, you'd have to change. In other words, here's the radical way to say it. Hashem runs the world according to the norms of our time. What else do we have? The Torah doesn't tell you. On the contrary, the Chazal say very clearly that the Torah's specific, or the Gemara's specific medical interventions are not valid today. And with very few exceptions, we're not allowed to do them. And if we did, we'd make a chilul, because they don't work anymore. For various reasons, when you go into the discussion of the fact that nature has changed, or whatever the reasons are. So I think that grounds the subject. But with your permission, let me talk about the question of risk and danger altogether, and I'll try to fit the question of immunizations into that framework. And you're very welcome to ask questions. Give me a chance to build the subject and try to show you what I think is a correct approach to this. And I'm very happy to take questions if I'm able to. I'm happy to answer if I can. But let's talk broadly about the Torah's approach to risk and danger and how we engage them. I wrote a book about this some time ago. That's called Dangerous Disease and Dangerous Therapy. That is a compendium of the halachas of this area. It's a very good book, although it's quite difficult, so I think if you buy 2 copies, then you'll understand it much better. But there you'll find a formal analysis of this subject with all the makaris. You can look them up yourself. And I've had the experience, the privilege really, of many years when I was living in Israel, I used to learn with Rav Zilberstein in Bnei Brak. In fact, I still do. They send me all the recorded material. And so most of the questions that I've had over the years, among other poskim, I've spent a lot of time asking him and picking up Rav Eliashiv's approach to these things. Some of these questions I actually asked Rav Eliashiv myself, and I'll share that with you. But let's take a broad view of risk and danger from a halachic perspective. And I think a logical way to approach the subject is to divide risks and dangers into 3 categories. There's a minimal risk category, there's a moderate risk, you know, doctors like to have things in categories, there's jaundice that you get from causes before the liver, in the liver, and after the liver. You know, we like to organize things in a logical fashion. And I think we can divide risk and danger, although the Gemara doesn't do this formally, I think we can make a categorization of risks and dangers in 3 categories. I very much doubt that we'll have time tonight to talk about all of them. I'd like to speak more about the minimal risk category, because I think it gives us a framework for placing immunization in context. But if there's time, we can deal with more as well. So let's go through these 3 categories and understand, if we can, the total approach to them. Minimal risk is not defined the same way halakhically as we define it conventionally. This is very important to know this. In modern science and modern medicine, we have a statistical approach to things. That's how we do things. That's very well established and very well accepted. Examples, let's say in genetic counseling. So if a family has a genetic problem, and the risk of an affected child is less than 5%, or 10% according to some opinions, we conventionally call that low risk. If there's more than a 10% risk of having a child who's affected, we call that significant or high risk. Why? Because experience shows that those cutoffs have certain meaning. Halacha is very skeptical about statistics, generally speaking. Yes, we have a concept of rov, a miut, and a miut that's significant and a miut that's not. But statistics, although the posek will ask you for a statistical cutoff, that's because he needs to get a sense of what kind of danger we're dealing with. But the halacha is skeptical about statistics in the same way that we use them in medicine. And any practicing doctor knows that statistics are very problematic. Gives you a broad overview in a population, but doesn't really tell you what to do in an individual case. And here we have a classic example of how Torah approaches this. We define minimal risk not by statistical cutoff, but by different standard completely. It is true that the minimal risk that we define by Torah standards happens to be statistically low as well, but that's not what makes it minimal risk. And here's how we define it. We have a concept that's called Dash Bo Rabbi. That means when the majority throng through a certain area, when society at large, not necessarily Jewish society, when society at large accepts a thing as normal, then the halacha condones it as a normal thing to do. And in that situation, the concept that applies is Shem Epsayim Hashem. God, Hashem, protects those who are simple, innocent, naive, whatever word you want to use, or go according to the norms. So, in other words, we're saying this, that what is acceptable halachically as minimal risk, and minimal risk means you don't have to make a risk-benefit analysis when you do that thing, not because it is safe enough statistically, but because society has accepted it. Of course it has to be very safe as well. Let me give you some illustrations. The British Journal of Medicine, not some time ago, they made the observation that many food additives and colorings that we use today have never been proved to be safe. Halachically, it's not a problem. I know in American society, there are segments of American society that tends to get very worked up about unnatural things, things that aren't organic. Good. But halachically, once a thing is broadly accepted, once society broadly has ratified this as a normal thing to do, halachically it's fine. Driving a car. Driving a car has certain risks. I'm not talking about Israel where it's high risk. Or maybe in New York City. You know, I don't know. I'm talking about normal places. When you drive a car, it's more risky than sitting home in your living room, unless you've got a very problematic marriage. You know. And yet, you can drive a car, halachically, without having to make a risk-benefit analysis. Is this journey worthwhile? Is it justified? Not because driving a car is safe enough, but because it's broadly accepted. Normal scheduled airline travel. A Jew does not have to make an assessment of whether this vacation or this trip or this thing is a mitzvah and therefore it justifies the risk and is a train safer. You don't have to do that. Not because there's no meaning to those figures. There is. We've got very good statistical evidence and analysis of how risky a plane journey is as opposed to a bus or a train. We have very good figures. If you read my book, you'll see at the back I have charts of the statistical risk of various professions and various modes of transport. The concept halachically is, not because that thing is safe enough statistically, but because it's a normal activity in society. Is this clear? Any objections? Yeah.
So let's take, for example, pregnant ladies used to be given X-rays, right?
Used to be given what?
X-rays.
Yes.
Eventually it was discovered that it was causing a lot of problems.
Yep.
Suppose you were from the first people that knew.
Okay.
But it was still considered normal.
Yep.
Would you be obligated
Good
to
question.
Tell people that?
Okay. The question, yes, of course. The question is this.
But if it's normal. But it's
okay,
it's
I understand. I get the question. The question is this. When you live in a generation where something's normal and you get preliminary evidence that the thing's not safe, are you governed and by the norm? And you have to tell people that, of course, once evidence starts to come in, you have to react. Absolutely. We're talking about when it's normal and not known. And by the way, the people who don't yet know are protected, and you're not. Because you're not a Pesi anymore. Shem Epsayim Hashem. Once you become knowledgeable, you're no longer governed by that category.
So then why are you obligated to tell them?
Because that's a natural process, and the evidence is coming in, and it will spread, and you need to do that, absolutely. But you don't have to be a fanatic about it. Okay, so hold the questions for a couple of minutes. Let me try to build a more comprehensive approach to this. I didn't really want questions. I just wanted to know if like, it was clear this far. So the concept we have is the thing normal? And again, we're not having regard to the fact that it could be that driving a car has a certain risk that is more risky than certain alternatives, provided it fits into a very low category of risk. The halachic concept is not that we have a 5% risk as opposed to a 10% risk. The concept is it's a normal thing to do. And once society, and I'm talking about normal things in danger, I'm not talking about moral things. When the society around you accepts as normal certain dress or certain behavior, that's yep, when the even when the Supreme Court decides that certain things are normal, I'm afraid that, what can I say, it doesn't make it normal. I hope they're not going to revoke my visa. But anyway, the point is... The point is whether this is a broadly accepted procedure or way of going about things in society. This governs not only the things you don't have to worry about taking precautions against, but it also governs things you have to do. And here we come to vaccinations. Let me give you an example. I was in practice in Israel, with another doctor in a certain community. And we had a family in that practice who did not want to immunize their children. And the two doctors in the practice, we felt it was a responsible thing to do. We wanted the kids to be immunized. And we got into a discussion with the family. And they were very committed to naturopathic medicine. And they felt that immunizing children damages the kids' immune systems, will cause problems down the line. Felt very strongly about that. And I'll never forget my conversation with the father. He said to me, why do we need to vaccinate the children? I went through the details. Then the argument turned out to be, very specifically, the whooping cough vaccine. The pertussis whooping cough vaccine, you're probably aware, is that, certainly at that time, I'm going back some years, was thought to have a certain level of risk. Even today, children with a history of neurological problems are not given that immunization. And then the figures were probably something like 1 in 20 to 30 to 40,000 children who have the whooping cough vaccine are seriously damaged by the vaccine. They either don't survive or have serious neurological damage due to the immunization. So the father said to me, why should I do that? So I said, the reason is very simple, and I gave him the conventional explanation. We do the math, as you Americans say. We do the math. We say that the risk of getting the disease and being one of the children who gets a serious complication, whooping cough is a very serious disease. Kids under age 18 months or 12 months, 3 to 4% of them die. And if you've seen one or two kids die, that disease, it changes, you know, it affects you forever. And therefore we say, the risk of getting the illness is a certain percentage risk. The risk of your child is 3 to 4%. And when you put that all together, the risk is far higher than 20, 20,000 of the vaccine. So we do the math. We accept the risk, knowing that there's a risk. I'm not talking about measles. I'm not talking about rubella. I'm talking specifically about a disease that is known where the immunization is known, or at least at the time, thought to have a certain risk. We are prepared to expose your child to this specific risk because the risk of the disease and dying from the disease is much higher. Straightforward, simple. While I was talking to the father, I realized I'm lying. What I'm telling him is completely inaccurate. Why? Because the real facts are these. If I give your child immunization, they have a 1 in 20,000 risk of dying from the vaccine. If I don't vaccinate your child, they have zero risk of getting the disease. Why? Because as long as everyone else is immunized, there'll be no outbreak of whooping cough and the kid won't get it. You know, the way it works in vaccines is like this. They have what they call an R factor. In epidemiological studies, what they do is they assess what percentage of the population needs to be immunized before you break a possibility of an outbreak. And for most diseases, viral disease spread among children, it's 95 to 96, 97, 98%. Once 97% of the population is immunized, these cases will be so sporadic they will not spread. And therefore you don't need to immunize the whole community. You need to immunize 97% or 95%, depends on the infectivity of the disease. And therefore, if 97% of the children are immunized, let's call it the whole population is immunized, if your child does not get the vaccine, they're not exposed to any danger, they're not going to get it. They don't need the vaccine. But that raises a classical ethical dilemma. Is it moral for you not to risk your child and have everybody else accept the risk so your child will be protected? That's a classic ethical dilemma. And we couldn't resolve it. So we agreed to ask Rav Eliashiv. And the family agreed to abide by what he said. And I'll never forget the experience. Late one night, the two doctors in the practice, myself and my partner, we went with the Rav of the community. We went into Rav Eliashiv's room. And we sat with him and we put the prong, and he told us it's permissible to force the family to have the vaccine. He didn't mean you hold them down, he meant that this is stuck. They are obliged to have the vaccine. On the way out of his room, I turned to Rav Eliashiv as a passing afterthought. And I said, surely the Rav has said that because it's not right and it's not fair for people to not immunize their children because relying on other people's immunity. He said, that's not the reason. He said, the reason is today it's normal to immunize children. And as an observant Jew, you're obliged to do what's normal. He actually said to me, he said to me, you should know as a doctor, that in the furthest reaches of the third world today, little kids are immunized against all these diseases. That's how normal it is. And if it's that normal, you're obliged to do it. Now, that's an amazing thing. He's not telling you that you're allowed to eat food that has food colorings in. He's telling me that you have to actually go out and immunize your children, because that's the norm today. And Hashem organizes and runs the world according to the norms. Very clear. The family accepted it. We immunized the children. Even though they weren't happy on an emotional level and that was not their personal orientation. So I learned an important lesson. The other approach is Rav Asher Weiss, for example, who was in London 2 weeks ago, gave a talk to doctors. He said this in Detroit recently, in Los Angeles, and in London. As you know, he's the Poesik Oshar at Tzedek Hospital, a major figure on the field of psych and certainly medical halacha today. He says a different thing. He says that it's irresponsible not to immunize your children because you're exposing other people to danger. But Yashi said because it's normal. That's one approach to this. He's saying something else. If you let your child get an illness, if enough children are not immunized so that we have an outbreak, you're endangering other people. And these diseases, as you know, can be dangerous. I don't have to tell you. I reprinted an article for you in your folders just to show you some of the interesting recent evidence on damage to children's immune systems by measles. You know, we've had deaths now, a number of deaths in California, the measles epidemic. In Israel, not that long ago, we had an outbreak of polio. People got hesitant about the vaccine, and with reason. There was one of the objections to the polio immunization, without going into technicalities. Polio has two forms of immunization. There's a live vaccine and an inactivated vaccine. But the live vaccine has a problem in that in extremely rare cases, the live vaccine that the child gets can mutate to an active form. And very often, if the mother's not immune, she can pick up polio from the child. So in extremely rare cases, one in many, many thousands, people can have paralysis as a complication of the vaccine, either the child or somebody close to the child. And that's why in modern immunization programs, they switch to the inactivated vaccine when they think that it's immunized high enough. But there was a time in Israeli history not that long ago when people were hesitant about this and stopped immunizing their children. And today we have paralyzed children because enough kids became vulnerable to the disease and we had outbreaks. This is what happens when you have a double problem. You have an outbreak of a disease in a community that's not used to this disease. If you go to the third world, African countries where I come from, kids pick up these diseases when they're very small and they get natural immunity. And so that's a whole different epidemiological and sociological environment. Different thing. By the way, the pediatricians will tell you, there's a current theory in pediatrics that our kids are too clean. Our children are too clean. There's a theory today, documented, that kids are brought up on farms, exposed to pathogens and allergens and bacteria, have much less incidence of allergies and asthma and things like that. And our kids are too clean. When you American ladies, you pick up the pacifier and you sterilize it and you irradiate it and you boil it, put the kid's mouth, you might be harming your child. I'm not saying you should give it to the dog to suck and then put it in your child's mouth. But who knows, it might be. So that is the thing. By the way, just as an aside, in New England Journal of Medicine about a couple of months ago, they published a very interesting study showing that children in Israel have a much lower incidence of peanut allergy than kids in America. You know why? Because they get bamba. They eat bamba when they're 5 months old, when their immune systems, the window of opportunity in 5 and 9 months, if you give your kids bamba between that age, they have far lower incidence of peanut allergy because they're exposed to these things, whereas, so it's a fascinating issue. So, those are some of the background issues. Let's take one step further. what happens if you act in good faith and you do what you ought to do, you give the child immunization, and this family gets harmed? What do you say to the parents? You say, we did the math, and Rabbi Dashi told us to do it, and we gave the immunization, and 1 in 20,000 children, this child gets a serious complication from the immunization. What do you say? The parents tell you, we didn't want to do this. So here's an important element of Ashkafa. Listen carefully, this is amazing. I hesitate to have to find the right way to say this. If you did what was correct and harm ensued, that harm was going to happen anyway. Maybe to put it another way, you never escape tsaros that are coming your way by illegitimate ducking and dodging. Right? If you do what's normal, you'll only get what was meant to be anyway. Let me give you an example. Some time ago in Israel, a woman was undergoing an emergency operation. Two gynecologists were operating. I think it was the excision of an ectopic pregnancy. During the operation, you're talking about two completely secular Israeli doctors, chiloni, totally, and they're operating, and the nurse was a religious girl. And the two doctors were talking to each other. So the one doctor said to the other one about the patient, this foolish religious lady, we told her to get sterilized, we told her she had a certain incidence of risk of an ectopic pregnancy, and we told her she'd get sterilized and not have any children. She went to a rabbi and she wanted to do mitzvahs and have children, and she got pregnant and her life is in danger. We're now having to remove one of her fallopian tubes. We were right, she was wrong. The nurse was very distressed. This lady, in all good, you know, she had bitachon, she asked the shayla, she became pregnant. But on the other hand, the fact is she's in danger now and the doctors seem to be right. And what do you say? So the nurse asked Rav Silberstein, what should I have said to those doctors? And he said the correct answer is that if this lady did what she ought to do and she was doing correctly with the right hashkafa and the right halacha and the right psak behind her, any trouble that she experienced was unavoidable. This is not happening because she did that activity. You never escape trouble coming your way by doing what you ought not to do according to Torah. And here's the illustration that he gave her. Now, from here on, no questions. Okay? Because now I'm going to tell you something deep in Kabbalah. This is where the questions stop. But I'll tell you what he said. You cannot do something illegitimate to escape trouble. The Midrash says that there was a man who came to Shlomo HaMelech and he begged him to teach him the language of the birds. So Shlomo told him, this is not a good idea. You don't want to do it, certain Kabbalistic Yisurim, certain thing. You know, it's not a good idea. But the man pestered him and he begged and he nagged. And finally, Shlomo HaMelech taught him the language of the birds. The man was overjoyed. He went out and he heard the birds saying that his chickens were going to die. So he sold all his chickens and sure enough they died. He was very happy. Then he heard the birds saying his house was going to burn down. So he sold his house and sure enough it burned down. He was very happy. Then he heard the birds saying he was going to die. So he went back to Shlomo Melech and he said to him, what do I do? And Shlomo said to him, you know, there was a gzer in Shemaim against you and Hashem tried to take it out on your chickens. Then you got out of that. Then Hashem tried to take it out on your house. You got out of that. Now there's nothing I can do. Okay, no questions, right? But you see from this that that's the attitude. And therefore, when you do what you ought to be doing, and you show me, you go with what is normal, and then you are, there's nothing untoward will happen that wouldn't have. Yes, your bitochen might be tested, you might have an issue in this area, that's all possible, but you have to act responsibly, and therefore, that is what Rav Yashu said. And you can come at it from various angles, but it is no question that it is normal today, immunization. Now, there are exceptions. I don't want to get into the technicalities. Many poskim say you do not have to immunize children against certain things. HPV, for example, that 12-year-old girls are now being immunized against, which depends on a lifestyle that is not a Torah lifestyle. That's probably giving the wrong message to engage in those things. There are immunizations that are newer, not yet proved. There's room to think about that. But I think the general policy should be that once a thing is standard and proved with mass evidence that we have that it's effective, and you're talking about serious dangers. Serious dangers, you read the measles article, for example. I know a young lady who is seriously, actually not alive anymore, she had a measles meningitis and was never able to function after that. I mean, talk about serious, serious problems. Give me a second, I'll take the questions. So you're talking about potentially serious issues and something that is widespread and normal. I think that should be the basic approach. Of course, you need to filter this through specifics, kids with specific issues, the pediatricians need to be involved, when there's reason to be concerned. When a new vaccine comes in today, we have an enormous, and so it's quite overwhelming. The number of vaccines that are on offer today, that the vaccination schedule offers, can be quite, you know, the numbers are increasing all the time. I myself hesitate about some of those. But that becomes a specific question about what is accepted, what's not accepted. Also depends on your sociological environment. In South Africa, where I come from, children are immunized against TB on the day of birth. In America, that's not done. But you're talking about a country with a very high incidence of very high risk disease. You'll be in contact with many people who have the disease. In that sociological reality, that's necessary. That's not, in other countries, that's not done. In England today, in Israel today, kids are not given a TB vaccine. The policy there is to wait till they're older and test them to see if they have become sensitive. And the ones that show a need or they go into a high risk area, they get the immunization. Not just given en masse. In countries where it's necessary, that is done. So I think this is a basic approach to the minimal risk category. The concept here, again, is not a statistical issue. It is what is normal in society. Such things you may do, and on the other hand, such things you're obliged to do. Let's stop here in case there are any questions about this specific element of the issue. Yeah,
so you're talking about that you feel that HPV vaccine shouldn't be given to Jewish children.
Should not be.
Right.
Moshe Weiss said last week, 2 weeks ago, he thinks that probably should not be done.
Right. So my question then is, how come hepatitis B is given at birth to Jewish children?
Why is given?
Yes.
People feel evidently there's more risk of that if a child's going to get a transfusion or be exposed to it in some other way. It's not only sexually transmitted, but then you could make an argument that that ought not to be done.
Yeah.
You could, yes. I've never looked into that specifically. I would have no problem with that if you find that in our community it's not.
Especially at birth to a tiny baby. I mean,
the reason it's given to tiny babies is because that's when it's effective and we want to protect them from that time on. Right? It's not done just because you like to attack tiny babies. No, there's reason. Okay, so a lot of the immune issues are done not because they're necessarily best for this child, but because we're looking for herd immunity. And therefore we start at a certain window. The concept in immunization in children usually is we want to get them at a time when the mother's antibodies that are circulating in the child are declining, but before they've declined enough that the child's vulnerable to the disease. That's a difficult issue.
But has a herd immunity had to do with hepatitis B, which is
You may be right. I wouldn't argue with it. I would try not to argue about anything, but I wouldn't argue that. Yes?
The CDC writes in the new adult vaccination.
Excuse me?
The CDC writes in the new adult vaccination plan that frequent outreach creates new societal norms.
Frequent?
Outreach.
Outreach. You mean teaching these things?
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to know, let's say, so what is the societal norm?
I mean, they're driving a norm that is unnatural.
If we create a norm, so is that, no, let's say now they're pushing TDAF shots and expecting women and things like that.
Yeah.
If they create a norm.
Yeah. The question is, what happens when a norm is created by being driven by advertising or...
Right.
I don't think that's relevant, halakhically. I think once it's broadly accepted in society, once we got to that stage, if that is the norm, Hashem is running the world that way. Mm-hmm. I don't think that makes a difference. Maybe in the phase when it's coming into being and it's not yet a norm, there's room to discuss, maybe. You know, in halakha, the principles are always clear. But the red line of clarity always has as a gray zone, which takes Da'as Torah or medical expertise or legal expertise to call those difficult decisions. And there's room for judgment and a room for personal assertion of your personal views in the gray zone. But once you have a clear thing that immunizing children today against measles, mumps, rubella, etc., is very broadly done in society, all societies throughout the world. And therefore, you can't argue that's not a norm. Yes?
Does that mean that if a subgroup is going with their own norm,
yes,
and it's not based on medical data,
yes,
there's Hashem does not apply to them?
Yes, when people break away from the norm and they invoke their own conduct for that group, and there's no justification, I'm not talking about a group that has different norms.
Okay. Do you feel that it's not based on ubiquitous data?
No, I don't think so. I think that that's wrong. And I think when people are emotionally attached to certain agendas, because they feel very strongly, based on anecdotal evidence or emotional stuff, I don't think that's right. I think we know, and we're admitting fully that the medical statistics here are subject to change with time, absolutely. But the best we can do is use the evidence we have. Yes.
When you're dealing with the $1 trillion pharmaceutical profits,
you're
constantly brainwashing.
Yeah.
You turn on the television and you see the commercials after commercials after commercials, advertising all these things, right?
Yes.
You go open a newspaper and every form of media.
How can you trust them? Okay,
when
good
you have medical schools which are subsidized by pharmaceutical companies that are that are teaching the doctors and the pediatrician.
Yep.
For example, my pediatrician himself told me about the HP vaccine, he said you should take it, the hepatitis vaccine, because one time he had a patient that one time went into a taxi and sat on a needle of somebody else that had hepatitis.
Right.
And I told him the chances of me getting killed in a car accident coming to your office is greater than that.
I think you're right. I think your doctor is a victim of all the newspapers and advertising. So. But I think you're overstating the case. The question here is like this. How can you trust the medical industry that is so biased by advertising money, trillions of dollars, forced education, et cetera, et cetera? I think that's a real problem. And I think we acknowledge that, and a lot of recent research has shown tremendous biases in medical research, no question about that. Biases of studies that are not published, negative studies that are not publicized. It's a very well-known field. But I don't think it changes the fact that once we're dealing with a norm where children are immunized and we have a system of very broad statistical studies where we try to bring out these things, right? And we try to show that we have a community-based thing based on extremely large numbers. We have that research. I think we have to be very skeptical about the research and keep a very watchful eye for where the biases creep in. But I don't think that that invalidates the whole exercise. Again, you can't overstate the case. If we take your statement to an extreme, it means like this, that it's all fake, and all the immunizations are only money, and they don't do any good, I think that's going too far.
But
Rav Eliashiv didn't agree with you. He said,
what? Rav Kanievsky did. I mean, you have on the other side,
really?
Rav Kanievsky said,
you know, I think you can find a rabbi who will say anything. So I think
I have a friend that asked Rav Kanievsky, and he said, Chisun, shtuyot. I mean,
I'm hesitant to accept that hearsay.
Okay, you can check it out. I mean,
I have a letter.
A letter saying Chisun Shtiyot. You have a letter saying?
Not in the letter.
I see.
Based on the idea of a rumor, based on the idea of kind of purpose, right, that everything Russian created in the world is basically perfect. So I always have this question.
What is perfect?
No, I'm saying basically, you see the beauty in Hashem's creation, everything matches perfectly. So the question I've had with vaccinations is that it comes with a question of basic. The idea of the vaccinations,
why should cope with its own issues?
I'm saying basically the idea is that if Hashem created such a beautiful world, so how can he create humanity so flawed at the same time?
The question is like this: if Hashem created such a beautiful and perfect world, why are we flawed and need things like vaccines? I'm sorry to have to tell you this: Hashem did not create a perfect world. He created a very damaged and fractured world. I'm sorry to disappoint you. That's the way it is. And we have a classic work on that, which is the Dice Tortoise. And the whole book is dedicated to showing you that Hashem created a broken world. We've broken it much worse.
Right.
Just one second. He created a world ab initio with a break in it. So we could have Bechira, and he works the whole subject out fully. It is true that over time we have made it much worse. Now that we've got a broken world, we have to do a lot of fixing. And the whole of medicine and a lot of Ishtadlis is...
I'm referring to Shalom Chena, which is, he shows the beauty in Hashem's creation. You see
the beauty in the creation, which is showing Hashem's incredible complexity and chesed, does not mean that it's a perfect world that works without fractures and breakdowns and diseases and pathology. It does not mean that. Yeah.
Is there in reality a link between vaccines and autism?
So the autism question is like this. The history of it is that in 2010, a study appeared in The Lancet, a very respected medical journal, showing that kids who had the measles vaccine have high incidence of autism. A couple of years later, it was retracted in humiliation as being a fake study. You know, that was retracted.
That's from the journal that published it.
Absolutely. Even
the author, Dr. Wakefield.
Excuse me. The journal that published it went through the embarrassment of having to admit that they accepted a fake study. Now, the problem is that a lot of popular opinion had already swayed in that direction. And although the study was retracted and there's no evidence...
Was that the sole source for the entire...
That was the key source that put this out. And voices have still been raised since then that this is an issue. You know the problem? The problem is that when you have a community, a society, and you have two things that are linked, to prove that the one thing causes the other is very difficult. if you show that most of the kids who have autism today got the measles vaccine, of course that's true. Everybody gets a measles vaccine. To show causation is a very tricky thing.
There's not been an explosion in occurrences of autism, and I understand it's not.
No, what you need is thousands of children given the vaccine, thousands who are not given the vaccine, the ones who got it got autism, the ones who didn't did not. We don't have such a study.
No, I'm aware of that. My question is has there been an explosion in instances of autism in the last 50, 200
years? Yes, there's been an increase in autism over the years. It's a very perplexing. We don't know why. And there's a big debate going on whether it's more case identification, so we identify more. The feeling is there is an increase in certain diseases. Autism is one of them, and it's unexplained today. But to put it down to measles vaccine...
I'm aware of the fact that there's not necessarily a link of causation.
That's right. Who says it isn't hepatitis A vaccine? Why pick on the measles?
Why wouldn't they want to do such a study? Why wouldn't...
It's unethical to do this. It's unethical to do this. It's unethical to... I'll tell you why. Because the norm today, and again, if you read my book, you'll see the criteria for an experimental study. It's considered unethical in the Jewish world and the secular world to do a study against a unprotected community. You need to do it against the standard of the time, against the best therapy we have, not against no therapy.
But there's thousands of parents that aren't vaccinating their kids.
Excuse me. You can't accuse them of doing all this and then require them to do a study that validates your...
If they're the ones saying it's safe, they should pay for the study.
If you can convince them to do it. I'm not against that. I think it's a great idea.
$1 trillion a year. Yes.
I think it's a great idea. I'm with you. You can sign my name to that. I think it's a wonderful idea.
They don't have problems spending all that money promoting the vaccine.
You're right. There's no question that the industry is self-interested, and this is clearly known, absolutely, and you have to see all the research with that bias. There's no question about that.
Then it's not unethical to do the study, because there are thousands of people that would...
Okay, if you can target enough people that it will not immunize, and that do not have another characterization, another feature that invalidates a study, you need to be sure that they represent the population in general. But they're not doing other things that might invalidate the study. You understand? In other words, what? That's right, you have to have a balanced population. For example, if you take a community of 10,000 people who never gave their kids measles vaccine, you might find these people are also eating organic food as opposed to the rest of the community. Remember, there are differences between people who are immunized. You have to control for that. So if you could raise such a study with enough numbers, I think it's a wonderful idea. Absolutely. By the way, you won't get researchers to do that unless they think there's a basis for this thing. Today, it's not accepted that there's a basis for autism based on the vaccine. Not accept the scientific community.
You'd have to make a case. Parents that see it, the next day they see their kid change.
But you're making a big mistake there. When you see a kid given a measles vaccine, the next day becomes autistic, that's because you've got the millions of people getting the measles vaccine and some people getting autism. So the parent links it. But the linkage is not a proof of causation.
Even if the next day it happens?
No, of course not. Because you're dealing with millions of people getting it. So a kid's going to get autism on a particular day. Millions of those kids are going to happen to be the day after the kid got the vaccine. You have to control for that. This is simple logic. This is not...
I'll say on Shabbos by a Kamea that if it works 3 times, then it's considered...
It's established, absolutely.
Right.
The Rambam says that too.
Right.
If you establish it, the fact that we don't understand it... The Rambam makes a chiluk between things we understand and things we don't. But what overrides that is when the thing has a validity. It's been used 3 times, it's valid, absolutely.
Right.
Listen, it doesn't have to be a Kamea. I've seen witch doctors in South Africa do amazing things that are impossible in modern medicine with my own eyes. Right? Weird stuff. So that's fine. I was very skeptical till I saw it. I have to accept it now. I saw it with my own eyes.
Yes.
I've also clarified, you touched upon it, but what's the halakha regarding shots that something like chickenpox, which are not usually fatal?
Chickenpox can be a very serious illness. Chickenpox, you get a meningitis, kids die of chickenpox. And again, even if it's not, once it's become the norm, first of all, chicken boss can be fatal. Hemophilus can be fatal. Chicken boss can be fatal. Mumps can leave you sterile. Okay, measles can be very serious. A rubella is not so serious, but if you're in contact with a woman who's pregnant, the kid can be devastated by the rubella. So we're immunizing the community, not because you're at risk, or the mother's at risk because the fetus is at risk. It's a community decision. And again, once it's a norm, it becomes halakhically the normal thing to do. Yes?
Do you one of the things he's saying is that statistically we can evaluate the risk versus the benefit. There's a certain number of people that get the disease and a certain amount of people that are getting ill from the vaccine.
Yeah.
As my
well, that was a particular example of whooping cough.
Right. My question is
it doesn't apply to the other disease.
One of the things that I found is that it's never reported, or not never, it's severely underreported. In other words, most doctors, when they encounter a reaction, they're not reporting it.
So well, which reaction? Autism? Which reaction?
Whatever reaction.
Well, which one? Getting a fever is normal, so they don't report that, because it's normal to have a fever 10 days after getting immunization.
Okay, let's say autism. Let's take that as an example.
So you have to put in place a very tight surveillance mechanism.
But it doesn't exist.
Because you can't do it, because we can't prove causation.
You don't have to prove, but at least report. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that you're saying that we have certain numbers, but what I'm trying to say is that the numbers aren't real because they're underreported. Most doctors...
You're making an assumption. You're making an assumption that it's happening and people aren't reporting it.
No.
We have very good mechanisms in place of surveillance, and I'm sure they're flawed. And by the way, you should know... There's a new initiative to do surveillance that's not under the control of vested parties. For example, an Israeli company that now looks for harmful effects by trawling through internet discussions. My brother knows a doctor, he works for the company. What they do is they look for side effects that are not reported. They look for weird and dangerous side effects by trawling through zillions of internet discussions of people seeking help for various things, and then they make links to drugs that have been used, and they discover some very amazing, probably causal interactions that are not being picked up by the regular surveillance, and we should be doing that. Absolutely. But don't get fixated on the idea that measles causes autism. You need evidence for that. Right? Today, the evidence, the hard facts, are not in favor of that thesis. But by all means, if you have a thing in your head that this is a real thing, research it and encourage the research. I'm not against it.
What's the absolute?
I don't have a vested interest.
What are the absolute minimum vaccines that you would suggest getting?
I really am not qualified to answer that. I think the minimum vaccines kids should get are the basic schedule recommended by the Academy of Pediatrics, whatever it is.
101
I think.
Kindergarten.
Excuse me?
101 vaccines by kindergarten.
That sounds too much to me. Yeah. That sounds scary.
Well, that's the norm.
That sounds the
norm.
Norm or not, that sounds scary to me.
That is the norm.
I would not want my child to get 100 vaccines before kindergarten.
In 10 years will be 200.
I think 100 vaccines before kindergarten is scary and abnormal. I don't think that's right. And I can't even think of 100 diseases.
It's not 100.
Yes, please.
No, it's not.
As far as their massive billions of dollars, I think we also need to consider that there's a big push today what's called evidence-based medicine, and that there is a lot of evidence-based medicine going on. There are many conferences that doctors go to where they're not allowing pharmaceutical companies to sponsor. Number one and number two, I think the biggest evidence-based medicine is the polio vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccines. The herd immunity has worked; it's worked very well. And I think people who don't understand that is classic evidence-based medicine.
Absolutely. Let me point this out, that what you're saying is that we have amazing evidence of the effectiveness of these vaccines, if you read the articles. But bear in mind, you're dealing with a community, and you have some voices here that are extremely skeptical about that. They think that this has all been faked, evidence has been hidden, that the doctors you're talking about, evidence they're trained and paid for by the companies. Unfortunately, this is the very strong attitude that it has to be dealt with.
Be educated that there is something called evidence-based medicine.
You don't have to convince me. Yes, please.
I'm of balance. And I think it would be more refreshing and more courageous and more expansive if we acknowledge that things are. The balance is changing. The only reason that you're here in the community speaking today is because there is a growing anti-vaccine community.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if that was acknowledged, and if we could in some way embrace that rather than pushing our personal agendas, which everybody here has their small personal agenda, I think the small-mindedness keeps us small. And instead of you know, in a few years following what the secular community is going to reveal to us about the anti-vaccine community, I think we should be proactive and embrace the change and have the courage to say, yes, you know what, there is something else coming up, and let's look at that and let's see how that can then help.
Okay, let me answer that, and I'd like to take one more step as well. The answer to your question is like this. If I embrace, you mean, let's be open-minded, let's watch the evidence that comes in, let's not insult these people, I think you're right. But if embrace means let a large segment of the population not immunize their children, that's a death warrant for thousands of children. It's a very serious problem. Okay? You can have a spread of epidemics, and children are dying of these things. This is a serious problem. It's not like an academic issue. So it depends what you mean by embrace. Let me take one more step, if I may. I think we've had our say, I think we've expressed our opinions, we all respect each other, and I think that's fine. Let me just add one more dimension, if I may. What about medium risk? We talked today about things that we call dashbo rabim, that are done naturally and normally. I think immunizations fit into that category, but certainly many other aspects of our modern lives do. Let's add, we want to make a thorough discussion here, not just a technical discussion. Let's just add a word. I don't think we'll have time tonight to talk about high risk, but let's talk about things that are moderate risk. Moderate risk means things that society does not ordinarily do. Things that are more risky than that. Statistically, they're more risky, but the common perception is that these things are more risky, and therefore people don't do these without due regard to the risk. Here we have a very interesting halacha, and the halacha is that you may do things like this, but only with good reason. The classic reason the Gemara gives is to earn a living. So the scenario the Gemara gives is people who pick fruit on the branches of very high trees, where there's a certain risk of falling, says the Gemara, if you're doing that professionally, you can do it because El Avinoi says Nafsho, brings a posit, and the Gemara says you can do things that are significantly dangerous. Again, we're talking about things that are very safe, but they're risky enough that people wouldn't do them without regard to the risk. There you may do those things for good reason. The classic good reason is earning a living. But Poskim say here very clearly that we're talking more broadly to get married, to live in a normal society. Somebody some time ago asked me, is it mutter to live in Johannesburg, South Africa today? Is it mutter? Is it too dangerous? You know, there's crime, there's issues. Is it too risky? And the answer is, well, if it's high risk, it's not permitted. But if it's moderate risk, that means quite risky. But in the category of moderate risk, the answer is, are you earning a living there? Do you have your normal social framework? Are your kids are being educated there? To move, you'd be a refugee? No, then it's acceptable. The problem with this category is, how do you define moderate risk? How do you define this? One of the difficulties here is we have many tshuvas on this, many responsa, and the problem with many of them is they were written long enough ago that we don't really know what the risk means. For example, most of these tshuvas talk about overseas voyages, where people used to go on business trips, used to sail abroad, and you have to know how risky were ship voyages 200 years ago, 300 years ago. We don't have a statistic or a feel for that. We know they were dangerous, much more than today, but we don't exactly know the figures. So the modern poskim try to give some sense of what these are. Going back, for example, to Nerdiv Yehuda, there's a very interesting tshuva. The Nerdiv Yehuda was asked by a Jewish big game hunter. He said to him, I trap animals in the wilds, and this has a certain risk with the wild animals. Am I allowed to do this? That's a classic tshuva. Nerdiv Yehuda writes, first of all, you have no business being a hunter. It's not a Jewish profession. That's an Esav profession. But from a halachic point of view, in terms of the risk, it's mutter. By the way, out in the wilds with the wild animals today is probably the safest place to be. It's the cities that are probably there. But be that as it may, he said, you are permitted to go do what you do because you earn your living doing it. Now, I'm fascinated to it. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked whether it's permitted to play American football. Can you play football? American football, you know, it's a game played by wimps and nerds with lots of padding. Not like rugby, which is played by real men. The point is that American football has certain dangers. Unfortunately, people have their necks broken, and you're probably aware that recent evidence has shown long-term brain damage due to head injuries and so forth. The question is that permissible? Rav Moshe writes that if you play professional football, which means you're earning your living doing it, the risk statistically is low. You're going into the game knowing that you might be injured, and knowing that you might be injuring someone else, but since it's a professional, it could be okay. what this means, he doesn't talk about for amateur football where you're not being paid. If the risks are the same, you'd have to assess exactly how risky is it. I don't know, because the Rambam says it's important to do exercise, needs to be exercise that you enjoy. He even talks about ball games. I don't exactly know.
The Moshe,
where? It's in the Gros Moshe. You want the exact number? If you email me, I'll tell you. I don't remember the exact number. It's in my book, by the way. So, if you look in the chapter on Risk and Danger, you'll see it's very clearly referenced over there. You need to look in the second copy. That's where you'll find it. But that's a very clear response. But he goes into the Gedorim of what is considered moderate risk, what is not. And there are many tshuvas that deal with these kind of issues. So that's a classic area of moderate risk. Many modern medical questions raise this issue. For example, a general anesthetic. Is a general anesthetic something that is so safe we could call it minimal risk? Or is a general anesthetic something that is already in the moderate risk category? On the one hand, general anesthesia today is very, very safe, right? If you go for a general anesthetic with no known problems, cold, elective surgery, in the best hands, about 1 in 40,000 people die in such circumstances, right? That's a very low statistical figure, but it is real. I know a young lady who 30 years ago had a nose operation and never woke up. She's been in an institution for 30 years, in a persistent vegetative state. She never recovered from the anesthetic. A simple nose operation, and that's what happens. So you do have risks, however they are extremely small. Is that small enough to make it called minimal risk, or is it moderate? Most Poskim say that no sensible doctor sends a patient for general anesthesia when you can get away with a local or some other med, and therefore probably we ought to consider that. Where this comes up often in tshuvas, in shilas, is things like cosmetic surgery, where we're talking about the risk of a general anesthesia not for a life-saving purpose, right? When you're doing something life-saving, of course you can do that because you're saving a little more life. But when you want the scenery readjusted in cosmetic surgery, you know, you want the bumps and dents, bumpier or less, you know, whatever it is. I mean, there you are talking about rearranging the aesthetic scenery, and of course that might be very important to a person. In fact, boys can say it needs to be significantly important. The person's impaired from getting a job or getting married. That's certainly okay. But they probably consider that to be moderate risk. In
but
cases where
work for children, it should make it easier for a dentist. Dental work for children,
yes.
This time than that, they're
I think
testing a lot.
Yes.
Even though it could be done with that, just
yes.
Lots simpler, just regular
yes.
Cavities and things.
I think most people feel that where a child is going to be very distressed and you've got multiple dental procedures that need to be done. I'm talking about a lot of distress for a child with injections and so on and so on. And don't forget that even local anesthesia has risks. Even local anesthesia has risks. Nothing. The Ramban says nothing in medicine is without risk. He says it in extreme fashion. He was a doctor too. The Ramban says what heals one kills another. So you're not talking about a zero against something. So probably general anesthesia, very, very professionally done, mild, light general anesthesia for dental work, is probably acceptable for children. Yes, I'm sorry.
A similar question with a lady and a neighbor with an epidural. There's obviously no harm that's going to come to her without it.
An epidural in labor, okay, I don't see the reason why you should want not to do that.
Well, in other words, she does not medically need an epidural.
Yeah. You know, the problem is you've never been through back.
That's part of the question.
But I think that the serious relief of pain, and by the way, in some difficult obstetrical situations, the epidural actually gets things going. It actually can help the labor. So if you need that, or if there's severe pain, sometimes the pain itself impedes the labor, I don't see the problem. Professionally done epidural is quite a safe procedure. It can have complications, but
it's as safe as general as
I really don't know the figures. I would suspect it probably puts in the same category. Yes,
has no effect on the baby also.
Yeah.
My question is that since in medicine, whenever we can do local anesthesia, we always do that over general. Would that by definition be not Dr. Bayram, and therefore moderate risk, not mild?
Sorry, would the local be that's what
since we always choose local over general anesthesia when there are both options,
yes.
Then wouldn't that by definition not be Dr. Bayram regarding general anesthesia?
But the Rod's question is if something is more is very well used medically, doesn't that become Dr. Bayram?
No, exactly. What I'm saying is you say Dr. Bayram means people accept it freely without
society
worrying.
Society broadly does it, yes.
Now, in medicine, we don't accept general anesthesia so lightly that it's like whatever you want. You want to be. We tell a patient, we try and convince them to do local. Oh, I don't want to know anything. But we try and convince them to do local if they can handle it, because there is some level of risk that we consider, even though Soramone, I think it's much less than 140,000 actually, but it's still not negligible like local anesthesia is.
Yeah.
So in my profession, we do that all the time. We try and do almost everything under local.
And therefore,
I would think, therefore, even though the general anesthesia is really low risk, it's still not
No, I agree with you. Yes.
In other words, I'm just trying to say that if you have simple option. To be moderate.
Yes.
If you have
absolutely. I think the consensus is that general anesthesia.
Clearly, moderate risk is when you, there's a reason. There's no problem with doing moderate.
I think the consensus is that general anesthetic is in the moderate risk. Rabbi Bleich has written that he thinks it's not dashboard. He thinks it's minimal risk.
So I'm asking is how could it be dashboard Rabin if medicine doesn't do it just for nothing?
He thinks it's so safe statistically that you can put it into that category. Who am I to disagree?
Based on the statistics, he's right, because it's probably close to 1 in 500,000.
I'll show you the study.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
But whatever, it's a very low figure.
I mean, in a healthy patient, it depends on their class.
Yeah. Okay, let me just add one more word and we'll stop here since we've all agreed about everything.
You have a number for when you don't say involvement of fascist apple, right?
When we're talking with high risk, risk to life, we don't use majorities. So the question here is, how can you talk about statistics altogether when life is in danger? Because the Gemara says, Exubas and other places, we don't use majorities when it comes to life-threatening issues. You know that the Shlomo Zalman said about that we talk of where we apply that principle is only when we have something specific that threatens life. So, for example, there are limits to that concept. Every patient who has, let's say, a cold, that might become pneumonia. Then we don't say that. You need the redev to be ninsa. You need the thing that is threatening life. Every patient with pneumonia is in danger to life, even though they have a very mild pneumonia, because pneumonia kills. But a person who's got flu, the fact that he could get pneumonia doesn't yet put him in the category of break shutters. So you need to know where we apply the statistic and we've done. Once you've got a life-threatening issue, even though it's very unlikely to kill, and even though even your intervention is likely to make a difference, then we break shutters. But we don't just say that anything could suddenly become dangerous, break shutters, anything. Let me just add one final word. There's a high-risk category too, and the question is, when does moderate risk become high-risk? Here's a fascinating discussion. The highest figure I've ever seen is one tshuva who says that Imre Esh, the name of the 1800s, that when you get to 1 in 6, 16%, 17% based on Gemara and Shavuos, he says that more than 1 in 6 is already considered irresponsible high risk. He bases the Gemara and Shavuos says that if a non-Jewish king mobilizes his army and he sends his army into battle and expects to lose less than 1/6 of his soldiers, he's not acting irresponsibly. Amazing. So Imre Esh says, based on that, if you want to engage in a profession where there's a 1 in 6 chance of dying, I don't know what that means, in a year, in a given year, in any military campaign, this is a tshuva to a Jewish soldier who asked him, can I be a mercenary in a non-Jewish army? If hunting's not allowed, I don't know how that's allowed, but anyway. Can I be a mercenary in a non-Jewish army? Very well paid. So what are the danger of dying? So basically this Gemara says if your risk of dying is less than 1 in 6 and you earn a living, you can do it. Rabbi Yashi said that's much too high. Much too high. He wasn't prepared to go beyond about 5% in earning a living. Right? And therefore, we talk about high risk at a very low level of statistical risk. And here you get into the fascinating discussion I'm not going to go into now. Under what circumstances can you put yourself in high risk? Obviously, we're talking about things like saving a life. Can you put yourself at high risk to save a life? And here we have a whole range of tshuvas, Israeli doctors asking questions. Am I allowed to drive down the road where there's going to be shooting to get to my patients, to save lives, to help them even to not save lives? Unfortunately, we have a very rich halachic literature on this issue. And very briefly, I'll just finish with this. There's a classic difference between the Yerushalmi and the Bavli on this. The Yerushalmi says you are required to put your life at risk to save someone else. You are required to put your life at risk to save someone else. Under certain limited circumstances. That's where you guarantee to save the life that's at risk, and the risk to your life is less than 50%. If it's more than 50%, you're basically halakhically throwing your life away. The Bavli says nothing doing when somebody's life is at risk, even if you guarantee to save them, if you're exposing yourself to very high risk, under 50% but high, you should not be doing this. The Chofetz Chaim says,
you're not allowed to.
And the Chofetz Chaim says, how do you know what's high enough that you're not allowed to and what you should be doing? And he and the Chasam Sofer and others say, don't be too frum about this. In other words, somebody's dying, so what should you do? Ask yourself, would you take that risk to save all your worldly possessions? In my case, it wouldn't make much difference. But if you, all you own is about to go down, would you jump into the sea to save that, run into a burning building to save that? If you would, then his life should be no precious to you than all that you own. And then you go into the burning building to save it. But if you genuinely would not save all your possessions, the risk is too great, then you could think about doing something else, saying to him, getting help, etc., but not jumping into the ocean. So in summary, I think this is a very brief overview. There's lots of good stuff to read about this. I know we're going to have differences. The feelings about immunization are very strong, obviously. I think the conventional medical world should be educating in a balanced fashion, taking into account the concerns and the biases. But I think we should be educating in this general direction. Have a good week.
Thank you. That's your question.
You're asking a question. The fact that the medical world doesn't do that, that change doesn't grow.
You recorded? Can I get a copy from you? I'll call you.
You recorded it, right? Yeah, so I'll pick it up for you tomorrow, right? Awesome. Thanks. So,
you recorded it?
Yeah, I recorded it.
I'm traveling back from a visit. I'm going to be here. 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 I'm going to be